Welcome everyone to Talking Shop Down Under. This is your host Richard Banks, and I'm sitting here at DDD Sydney in a very open area, kind of near the toilets as it turns out, but don't let that freak you out. But I'm sharing a lounge with the manly and rather good looking Malcolm Sheridan.
Hello, hello.
A little bit of geek love going on. Hello, Malcolm, baby.
How are you, Richard?
Oh, I'm all right. So, you've just done your session. I've just done my session. So, we're both session free for the moment.
We're free for the rest of the day.
Well, I'm not. I've actually got to do some more panel talks, but...
Oh, okay.
But they don't require preparation. we won't tell the audience or anything like that, but... Yeah, you know, we just kind of rock up and go, let's ask a few questions.
Yeah. Well, Aaron is on the panel as well, isn't he?
Yes. So I'm hosting the web panel. I'm emceeing that one, but I'm on the open source panel as a panelist.
Excellent.
Which
excellent.
Is nice. So tell us a little bit about your session. Actually, before we do, tell the listeners about yourself.
Okay. I work for ANZ. I am a quantitative project manager, which means that I'm in charge of some quants at ANZ, so they do a lot of...
So, for those not in the financial realm, a quant is like a quaint person. And they're the ones that wander around in their like three-piece tuxedos and suspenders and stuff?
Yes. Basically, these guys have all got PhDs in mathematics.
And no social skills.
Exactly, exactly. No life. No, they're all geeks. They're all pure geeks. And these guys are all... C. These guys are all C programmers or Fortran programmers. So I'm in charge of making sure that they calculate things like interest rates, mm-hmm. CCRs, all that sort of stuff correctly.
But the Reserve Bank calculates interest rates. They don't have to do anything. They just go, you know, 0.5% on top and raw people straight away 0.5% up. And
yeah, we need to make sure that we're getting our cut as well. So that's what these...
that's what I'm saying.
That's what these guys are doing. But... I am also a Microsoft MVP, and I am also a Telerik insider.
Ooh.
So Telerik are a wonderful component company.
Oh gosh, I'm going to have to cut this bit out.
And thank you, Telerik, if you're listening. And they actually are flying me up here to do this session this weekend.
So when Joel Simoniak was around, you hung out with him for a while and...
Yes, hung out with Joel. Hung out
with... Dude, mate, come out with me. Let's go show you the town.
We actually went out with Stephen Forte and Joel and everyone. So, Steve, if you're listening, hello. But it was fantastic to have the guys down, and they may be coming down for Tech Ed Australia and possibly New Zealand.
Oh, very nice.
And possibly...
Now, your MVP status is in what field?
ASP.NET/IIS.
Oh, you're one of the new IIS people.
I am one of the new IIS people, and I think they've created that just because there are so many ASP.NET MVPs. They don't know what to do with them.
Well, they've become IE MVPs, haven't they? A bunch of them.
Well, yeah, I'm not exactly sure what an IE MVP is. I mean, if you're an IE MVP, do you use Firefox? I mean, is that illegal? Or?
I don't know. So we know a few of them. We should ask, I assume.
Well, I do know a couple of them. Maybe a... You know, I just used someone's laptop for my session who is an IE MVP. I won't name names, but he did have
Firefox Chrome Opera
on there, so I'm not sure what he's doing with all that.
Was he running Lynx?
I didn't see that.
Because Lynx is the best browser ever. Or actually, the one I like using is WebIE. Have you played with that
WebIE
one?
Is nice,
that's
yes.
That's the one, for those who don't know, that does the usability side of things. So you can switch it into blind mode.
Nice. But... I must say officially, because I am a Microsoft MVP, I only use Internet Explorer.
Liar. The web is a broad place. You're allowed to get outside of the ghetto occasionally.
Yeah, I love Firefox.
Firefox. Actually, that sounds a bit wrong, maybe.
If we're in the Bronx, it might be acceptable. But I love Firefox. Firebug is the best development debugging tool there is. IE's developer tools is great, but you know the thing that really annoys me about that is it always pops up on a different window.
Indeed.
And that's annoying.
It is. All right, so let's get on to the subject hand, which is deploying these web things so that your browserness that you've stuck yourself to, even though you're an IIS person, can access what it is you just deployed.
Yes.
That's a nice way of saying web deployment, right?
That is
probably
basically
a crap way
what,
of saying it, but you know.
I didn't really want to correct you then, Richard, but it is web deploy. So my session today was Easy Web Deployment, Begin the Enjoyment, a nice catchy title. And it was basically going through all the different configurations through Studio 2010, how you deploy through the command line, how you deploy through the IIS manager, differential database deployments, also showed how you deploy like registry settings, comm settings, all that sort of stuff.
Comm?
Yeah. So, there are still companies out there that are using comm objects, and unfortunately we need to cater
in a
for
web
them.
Application.
Yep.
So scalability is great for those guys.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are these the same guys who are running Word on the server to do page rendering?
I didn't actually say print
to Word documents. Let's run Word.
It could be. But we are some of those companies who still have those things running. So yeah, but Microsoft need to cater for everybody or the greater majority, and there are people still running that stuff. Well, I mean, look at us. We're still running Fortran.
Well, yeah. Oh, I was talking. Yeah, okay. We won't go. Fortran.net.
Yes.
Uh huh.
Yes, but
that's yes, Richard. Pat you on the head.
Yes, Richard.
Good boy.
Yes. But for people who aren't aware, I did the same session at Triple D Melbourne, and my laptop pretty much died at the very beginning of my session. So what I did was I went out and bought a brand new Lenovo W520. From several people's recommendations. Awesome laptop. Got here to Sydney.
I'm sensing a bit of product placement. Have you got some kickbacks going on?
I haven't got anything with Lenovo, but if you're listening, I do love Lenovo. But hooked it up to the projector and it would not project. So I ended up using Aaron Powell's laptop, which, as you know, as a presenter, you become familiar with
your own
laptop. Everything's set up correctly. And unfortunately, the presentation didn't go as well as it would have had I done it on my laptop. One thing broke, which I was a little bit disappointed about.
So there's a phrase that comes to mind, you know, about bad tradesmen and blaming their tools.
I am blaming Aaron's laptop, and he is the tool.
Oh dear. All right, so we should get onto some real content, because everyone's probably at this point going, these guys have been talking for far too long about nothing. It's like a Seinfeld episode. So web deploy is V2 now, right?
It is V2. So web deploy is a pretty word for MS Build. So think of it as a lot of UI on top of MS Build. So it allows you to package everything up into one zip file, and in that zip file you've got a parameters file, and that parameters file contains stuff like the application pool name, the website name, the folder where you're deploying things, database scripts, comm objects, all that sort of stuff that you can configure through MS Build, you can do through the UI. So web deploy is just a fancy way of doing MS Build, basically.
So if you wanted, you can get into the MS Build XML mess under the hood?
Oh, definitely. And that's actually the one demo that didn't work today.
Okay, so with things like the MS Build community tasks and so forth, all those you can just drop in yourself.
Yep, definitely.
Can you do that via the tooling, or are you stuck? So with basically the tooling does the 80% of what everyone does.
Yeah.
And then if you want to do the interesting bits, you've actually got to go and dive in yourself.
That's exactly right, yeah. So the tooling does 80%, the majority of cases, which most people, you know, are happy with. But for the guys who really want total control over their deployments, they do need to get in and get their hands dirty, which is, you know, a lot of the guys that you and I know.
Well, most people, actually. There's very few places that just want build a package, push, deploy with nothing else, other than, I suppose, single server web apps with nothing else on them.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
MS Deploy, or it's not MS Deploy, it's Web Deploy, right?
Yep.
It used to be called MS Deploy.
It used to be called MS Deploy.
And then they renamed it to Web Deploy and V2 and whatever else.
Yep.
So Web Deploy is something that's done inside of Visual Studio.
Well, no. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. Yes, it is inside of Studio 2010. No, it's also available in WebMatrix. So for the listeners that do know about WebMatrix, the deployment process that WebMatrix uses is WebDeploy. So you can web deploy to a hosting provider, you can web deploy to a local box, you can use FTP deploys. Everything under the hood is all using MS Build. So MS Build is not just limited to Studio.
But that's where the main interface is. So
definitely.
You either use it through that or through another IDE, effectively.
Exactly.
So does this then mean you've got people who are encouraged to do works on My Machine deployments? So they build the code locally, they run their MS Deploy package locally, and then they give it to the ops guys and say, here you go, we've tested this. Trust me.
Yes, unfortunately, that's how most web applications do get into production. But web deploy is not just all about the UI. I mean, there is also the command line interface that's built. Sorry, I need to hold my microphone close to my mouth. Rich is telling me. And, so when you need to hand off the deployment off to an IT guy, that's when you would hand them a CMD file, and they can just deploy through the command line, or you can give them a package file, which they can deploy through IIS. It really depends on the person.
But that's still coming from binaries and things that were built on their desktops, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So if we wanted to put this as part of the build process, how would that work?
If you wanted to have that as part of the build process, you need to install WebDeploy on the actual build server. Now, WebDeploy is downloadable as a separate download through the web platform installer. You can install that separately, install that on your build server, and move everything off your machine onto the build server, and hey presto, you've got a bit of CI happening.
So there's it basically gives you a command line option to do the build then,
absolutely,
does it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because normally, you know, you get these tools, and it's like, it's there as a right click to build package or whatever it is in Visual Studio.
Yep.
And everyone just goes, oh, okay, fine. How do I call this build package from my build server? I don't know. Do I run DevEnv and try and do it via that? And that obviously... Not the best solution,
but it's important for everyone to remember that WebDeploy is MS Build.
Okay, so you'd use Visual Studio then to create your deployment package structure?
Yes.
And the settings and so forth?
Yep.
So what's actually in those settings? What is it we're trying to package up?
So, basically the things that you want to package up or the things that you want configurable are where the website will be deployed. So it either can be deployed through WebDeploy, FTP, or a local IIS box.
Mm-hmm.
You can deploy things like the application pool, registry settings, COM settings, COM objects, DCOM objects, GAC installs. Basically everything can be configured through WebDeploy.
And does it do the handling of things like upgrade deployments versus fresh install? So if you mentioned, you know, creating the app pool, what if the app pool's already there, does it do things to detect the app pool's there and just...
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So it's not going to go through and just delete the app pool if it already exists. It's going to do a check first to see whether the app pool does exist. If it does, it'll use that. If it doesn't, it'll actually go through and create a new one and just do everything.
Okay, so then it's effectively a declarative approach to deployment.
Basically, it's
similar
yeah.
to how database projects work, in that you create the schema that you want to deploy and then you point it at a database and it goes and magically just kind of... rips everything apart and breaks everything and scares the DBAs.
Yes.
And then puts it back together and somehow everything's working and you're like, wow, this is great. And all the DBAs are there, you know, pale in the face and
yeah.
and shaking and have probably
angry.
Wet themselves in fear.
Yes, basically, yeah. But look, you know, in preparing for this presentation, there are a few little annoyances with WebDeploy that your listeners might not be aware of, and that you'll only actually discover these when you're trying to do like an in-depth talk on WebDeploy. So there are a few things that just to watch out for.
So there's a few cut glass, broken edges, jaggies that are going to bite.
If you're running your hand around the edge of WebDeploy, you might cut your finger every now and then. So you just have to put on a pair of gloves, and then you'll be right.
Okay, so the big rubber glove goes on and everyone gets really nervous, but what are some of the edges, what are the things that bit you?
Well, one of the things that really bit me was around database deployments. So database deployments would seem quite straightforward, but if your database exists, the deployment will fall over, because basically web deploy will just go off and the first statement it will run is do a create database statement. And if the database exists, it will fall over. So So what you need to do is you actually need to right click on your project file. And you need to add...
Your project file being the deployment project? Well, is it a deployment project?
It's not a deployment project.
It's just actually a thing in the solution, isn't it?
It's basically just a web forms application. It can be MVC. So it can be... it's like agnostic to the language.
Okay, so but the database is a database project? It has to be a DB proj file? Or can it be SQL scripts and change scripts and things like that that you just want to apply?
If you're doing a normal database deployment out of the box, it's a SQL script. But the first thing it will try to do is create the database. And if it's there, it will fall over. So what you need to do is you need to edit the project file.
You
need to put in a little attribute which says detect if database exists or something like that. I can't remember. And if you put in there, it's set to true. You know, hey presto, it won't try and delete it or create it. It'll just go, hang on, it already exists. I'm just going to go and run the scripts. So it's these little things that...
Doesn't that seem kind of fundamental? Like, if we're doing deployments, we want to do it via this automated tool regularly.
Yes.
Therefore, we would expect the database to exist.
I'd think so, yes. Yes.
Okay, so it's not just me who thinks.
No.
What are you talking about, Willis? This is crazy.
And also another thing to look out for is if you're installing through IIS Manager, you actually need to have a separate install for IIS Manager. So there's a web deploy for IIS that you need to download, because when you open up IIS Manager...
Oh, you mean on the server side?
On the server side, on your build machine. It would just be on the server side, because this is only if you're installing the package through IIS. So when you open up IIS Manager, there's a little... link which says, I think it's import export package. Now, if you don't install the web deploy for IIS, it's just not there. And in the end, you have to go through, you know, a Google or a Bing search to find out why it's not there.
Nice.
It's just these little things that just aren't obvious when you start.
Okay, so it kind of feels like it's not even 80%. That it covers. There's all these little edges and things like that aren't really edges. They're more like, you know, big speed bumps for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Do I dare ask about farm deployments?
You can.
Because I'm guessing that the 80% scenario is single server deploys.
Most of the time, yeah.
To an existing site or a site that you've created.
Yep.
That you then... just go and push the website content into and the CSS and so forth and maybe a little bit of database stuff, but sounds like you've got to go and do nasty things. In a farm deployment, you've got one database that's shared across, you know, seven machines in the farm, and generally you want to pull a machine out of the farm, upgrade that one, make sure it's okay, and then roll the deployment through the others. Does it do anything like that, or is it worse?
No, it does... It doesn't actually, like, if you're in a web farm situation, it doesn't do, like, you know, session bleeding like you do off a load balancer. It doesn't do anything like that. But basically, you can do web farm deployments with this, but you just need to be careful about some of the things that you can cut yourself on. And once you actually understand those little things, the annoyances about it, it's not a bad tool, to be honest.
So is it worth using the tool, or is it easier just to do like PowerShell scripts?
You know what? If you're in an enterprise situation, I think it's far more beneficial to use a PowerShell script and actually automate things from start to finish. This is a great way of getting to understand how MS Build actually works and getting familiar with MS Build and getting familiar with what doesn't work with MS Build.
Okay.
But it's not actually MS Build that's doing this. It's all, you know, the SQL scripts that just aren't configured correctly at when you actually deploy or build your package. But personally, like, I've used this as a tool for getting started with like a deeper understanding of MS Build. But PowerShell is definitely the way to go if you need to do like automated deployments to like one server or multiple servers.
Yeah, because the PowerShell, if you did a PowerShell script, you could definitely put in parameters to control certain behavior and detecting things and so forth. There's enough PowerShell goodness around now with, you know, managing SQL servers and managing IIS through PowerShell and all those various commandlets that do that stuff, that I start questioning. This is probably not the right tool for a large deployment, but it's good for doing small, simple things and just making it easier to push things out for your own sites. And I suppose the fact that it's in WebMatrix kind of implies that it's targeted more at the lower end of the deployment spectrum.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Most of the time when you go into an enterprise corporation, people have got their own deployment methods. Mm-hmm. Like they'll either be deployed through...
Documentation. Read my deployment doc.
Most people, you know, either use like TFS to do builds. They can use NAND, PowerShell, like you said before. So I think the way to describe this is, yeah, it's definitely good for beginners to understand and to get a better knowledge. But if I was using this in an enterprise situation, like if I showed this to someone, like a network guy, and said, use this to deploy... they'd probably tell me to go away. They go, "What? I need to install something."
Nuts?
Yeah, exactly. So,
but you don't need to install anything, do you? You deploy effectively once you build the package. What do you get? You get a zip file and a batch file.
Well, you get
CMD or something.
Ultimately, you do get one zip file, and that zip file contains XML files, which are parameters. Mm-hmm. Contains all your project files, all your assemblies, everything you need to be able to deploy it. And also, you do get a batch file, which you run to install through the command prompt. But if you want to install through IIS Manager, you just basically import in the zip file.
And that's if you're doing it through IIS Manager.
If you're doing it through IIS Manager. So if you're doing like a web farm, probably that's not the way to go. You'd actually like script it up and you know, use the actual command file.
Yep. And do that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what are some? You mentioned COM files and doing things like that, and GAC installs of assemblies and so forth. Are there any edges around that to watch out for that you know of? You're giving me the look. This is the look at this point that says, "Oh, I don't want to talk about it."
There are a few things. Like one of the most if your listeners and everyone cast their mind back to the wonderful days of COM. And like RedServe 32,
ooh, baby.
You need to be aware of always remembering to unregister everything first, and then registering later, which sometimes doesn't happen. And then you get into the old DLL hell, which thankfully people who work in .NET in the last 10 years or 7 years don't have to worry about that anymore.
You'd also have issues if you were using that one COM component shared between multiple sites on the same server.
Definitely.
So you'd have to actually stop all the sites or basically pull down IIS completely.
Yeah, I haven't actually done like a deployment where we're using the one COM object for multiple sites. So most of the time that I've used this is exclusively where we've got one COM object that's used for one website. So we can easily just, you know, take down the website, unregister it, re-register the new assembly, and then Bob's your uncle, things work. But you know, there are some things that you just need to be aware of when you're doing this. But if you're still working with COM, you've always got to be careful. Like, it doesn't matter how much preparation you do, something always goes wrong.
No, really?
But
it's not DCOM, right? COM Plus?
No.
So you're not doing remote COM components.
I haven't come across that, but you know, I'm sure there are people who have still got DCOM objects out there.
I'm sure they do. They're probably still using VBX files as well in places. Actually, talking of old school technology, let's change things for a second. So you mentioned Fortran before. We were having a chat this morning and you were saying, I'm getting into Fortran,
love Fortran.
Now, I'm one of those people who's heard of Fortran and generally derides it without actually knowing anything about it. So that's a question, by the way.
Okay. Because most of the work that we do at work, calculation intensive, like they're very calculation
on numbers.
Like, so speed matters. So we need to push out as much work as we can, like per cycle. And the only way you can really, really do that is using a functional language like Fortran. We're not using F sharp like we talked about earlier, just because the guys are old school, so they know Fortran and C. And Fortran, I had the same skepticism when I was first introduced to it, that I thought, oh my God, this is an old language, why are we still using this? But the power that you do get out of Fortran is unbelievable what it can actually do. And I can't actually describe it. I mean, there's not...
Without giving away corporate secrets.
Oh, well, I can't give away any corporate secrets, but it's fast. There's no state and it's all functional.
Is it... It's fast because they're the only app running on their mainframe?
It's just an absolutely fast language for doing calculations.
All right, so it's a functional language. So things that we've been doing in C sharp and in F sharp for those who've played with it, and even in JavaScript, for instance, same type of approaches are being taken in the development of the Fortran stuff. That's what's effectively developed, or is it functional languages that have a different flavor and feel to it than what we're seeing in modern languages?
I think old languages, especially like Fortran, have a different flavor and feel to the new languages. I mean, these are really, really old school languages that people like, you know, you and I don't normally work with. I certainly don't normally.
Or want to.
Well, you know,
COBOL's a really fast language.
COBOL is a...
So is Assembler. ASMX86, you can make that thing fly.
Do you know we've actually got COBOL still running at
I'm not surprised. It's bank, right?
Well, yes, I do work for a bank. But Fortran is a great language when you need... Like when speed matters. Speed matters. And some of the work that we do, the calculations are monolithic. So we like running them through a C sharp application, it just wouldn't cut it.
So you're running on a mainframe, I assume, or midframe or something like that.
An old mainframe.
Is it a series of, or it's just one machine, and you're not doing cross machine calculations like MapReduce or splitting calculations into sections? And
no, we're not doing, like, I'm sure there would be other parts in the bank that are doing something like that, but for our work, everything's just run off the one machine. So,
and the nature of the calculation, even though you've written it in a functional manner, you're effectively, you say, monolithic.
The calculations are quite huge. Like, as I'm not a mathematician, but just to like calculate CDS pools, SI schedules, like ROE returns, they're huge. And the biggest thing with these calculations is they come in and they've got different curves. So think of it as like a waving graph.
Mm-hmm.
So the wave can have different points, and each point can have like different calculations with that point. So it's like a big tree structure, but it's a big tree structure. And these things need to be calculated, and they need to be calculated fast and correctly. And we did try to move away from Fortran, I must say, but the results that we were getting
weren't so good.
The speed issues were like the number one thing.
So was that a hardware scale factor, or you were trying to, you know, you were doing something on a mainframe that was obviously huge and sucked up half of Sydney's power supply? And then you went and said, let's write it in, you know, .NET or some managed language, which has its own speed issues inherently, but then ran it on a desktop.
You know what? The servers that we ran this off were pretty beefy.
Yeah.
And the C-sharp calculations weren't keeping up with the old Fortran. They were pretty beefy servers. Like, you know, these things had, you know, 64 gig of RAM on them, mm-hmm. multiple cores. And
you wrote it single-threaded, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Why would I use all those cores? That's crazy.
I don't know why Intel are making all these cores. But it all came down to speed and also the fact that, you know, these libraries were created by, you know, these guys many, many years ago, and they're entrenched into the banks, way of life. And, you know, they wouldn't change it just for us.
So... I suppose there's other issues then about what happens when these guys actually retire, and I'm sure there's concern over that.
Well, yeah. Well,
they just won't retire.
They're
like, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean 100 years before the mast sort of thing. They just become part of the ship.
Well, you know what? Like, in every company, there are people that you just cannot sack. That's true with, like, some organisations.
Which means you can never promote them either.
Well, you can. I'm certain you can give them more money just to make them feel good at night time when they go home. But there's certain people that you just cannot sack from organisations, and like Fortran programmers. There's not that many of them out there.
No, they're like FoxPro programmers.
Well, yeah. I actually met up with and one of the original FoxPro MVPs at the MVP Summit last year, John Peterson. He was telling me how he loved FoxPro, and I was having very comical arguments with him over...
You're trying to bite your tongue. The yes. blood pouring out of your mouth gave you away.
Yes. But, I'm thankful to say that I don't know of any FoxPro programs at work, but I'm sure there might be one or two.
Probably. There's probably access floating around... Lots of
access, lots of Excel.
Yeah. All right. So, Malcolm, do you want to plug anything as we get towards the end of the episode? Things you're doing, talks you're giving, tech eds?
Tech eds, yes. I'm doing 2 and possibly 3 talks at Tech in New Zealand, and that is August 24 to 26.
That's great, bro.
Thank you. I'm doing 1 session at Tech Ed Australia, which is August 30 to September 2nd, and that's on real-world MVC problems.
Real-world?
Real-world MVC problems. Like, one of the things...
With Fortran mixed in?
No, there's no Fortran in this.
Man.
But one of the things that sort of sometimes annoys me at these conferences that you and I go to are some of the demos really aren't geared towards what people do in day-to-day life. So this session is about real-world problems and how to solve them, not just like fluff.
Yes.
Yes. And also... Telerik. Have to thank Telerik once again for flying me up to Sydney. They are a fantastic company.
And you are wearing the .NET Ninja Telerik shirt at the moment as well.
Yes, yes.
Are you wearing your Telerik undies? I don't want to see you, by the way. I'm just checking.
I'm not.
Ooh, he's gone commando. I'm going to have to cut this bit out.
That's all I can plug at the moment.
That's all? Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's all. I'm going out to Adelaide as well.
You're doing DDD Adelaide?
DDD Adelaide on July 16.
Excellent. So that's good for the South Australians. They get to have a little bit of 1920s tech conference. Hi, Adelaide.
And hopefully my laptop works in Adelaide.
Just borrow someone else's. It's safer.
I'll have to borrow someone else's. Yeah.
You know, you could use like an iPad with a remote desktop session.
I didn't think of that.
See,
I could.
You could host a VM worker role in Azure. Put all your demos on that.
You know,
connect up via the iPad with a remote desktop, and then you know what would happen?
What?
Azure would probably kill your instance just as you're about to do the demo.
I was going to say, look, let's not get started on Azure or. Azure or whatever
people... Azure.
But I think that's a totally another discussion. I've got some fairly strong opinions about
that. So I didn't ask about web deploy for Azure. It doesn't support it at the moment, does it?
Doesn't support it at the moment. And I don't know of any plans of them supporting it in the next version either.
Because they've got their own deployment thing. They've create your Azure package and then you push it up to Azure and you wait 20 minutes for it to deploy.
Basically, yeah.
So fast. There's a big pregnant pause as Malcolm's sitting there going, I don't know how much I should say. This is being recorded.
I do love Microsoft.
So I just had my MVP thing renewed this morning.
Congratulations,
so I've
Richard.
I've got, 12 months to recover from this particular folly.
Yes, it is 2nd of July, so it's 1st of July overseas. So congratulations on becoming an MVP for how many years
this
now?
This is the second.
Second years?
Yes.
2 years now?
Yes, but that's not important. It's recognition for the community. I'm all about the community.
Exactly.
Love you guys. Without you guys, I wouldn't have an audience. Did you know that?
Yeah, we love you too, Richard.
Oh, it's beautiful. Let's just have a moment. All right, and with that, I think we should end. So thank you, everyone, for listening. This is a live session recorded at DDD Sydney again. props to Lewis Benj and Aaron Powell for putting this on, and for their partners for helping with all the admin as well. And for everyone else, we will catch you on the next episode. And until then, happy coding. See you later.
Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.